Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
This week on The Wheelhouse, women, their right to politic, their right to live. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. Democracy in the U.S. is under attack. There's political violence, disinformation on our news feeds, and harmful rhetoric coming from our politicians. And where democracy is under attack, so too are the rights of women. Threats against women and threats against democracy are linked, according to experts who study and track gendered political violence. Today, we're going to look at the experiences of some of the most powerful women in politics, how they're spoken about, how they're spoken to, and what that means for all of us. And later, we're going to dive into the attacks on reproductive rights happening in Alabama and beyond. With me this morning, I've got tremendous guests. We're representing Massachusetts this morning. With me this morning, academics in Massachusetts, I should say. Kelly Carter Jackson, Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Good morning, Kelly.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on this morning, Kelly. Sarah Soberai, the Professor of Sociology at Tufts University. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Sarah.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you. Sarah, you're going to get the first question here. Before I give you that question, though, I just want to tell folks, call in today. Give us a call, 888-720-9677. Feel free to share some of the inspirations that you have for women in politics and women in the world. Give us a call, 888-720-9677. Sarah, the world of politics, still dominated by men. You got to look at this year's U.S. presidential election, 2020s. What are some of the factors responsible for that?
Why is it still dominated by men?
Why do we give men this power that we don't give women, like allowing a woman to be president or something like that?
It's interesting they use the word allowing, because I guess the way I think about it is, why aren't we supporting women who are?
That's a better way to put it. Thank you for that.
Yeah, so I think there's a number of contributing factors. One is there's sort of that classic catch-22 that women have traditionally been seen as, you know, ill-suited for politics because there are beliefs about them that suggest they are emotional and irrational and soft and these types of things. But when women behave in ways that are incisive or assertive, uncompromising, they're caricatured as, I'll use the word battle axes, but the other B word, and heartless, they're read as, you know, not likable. And so there's a resistance in this very tiny tightrope that, you know, someone has to walk in order to be sort of viewed as acceptable. And I also think that as a result of this history of the public being quite, you know, cautious in supporting women, it ends up impacting their fundraising ability early on. There's questions about whether they're a credible candidate, right? So it can sort of spiral and become a almost self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, that is this person electable? Well, there was a poster about Elizabeth Warren that said she's electable if we vote for her, right? So I think that's part of what's going on.
Kelly, you got a good chuckle out of a couple of things in there. This is very important to think about that. I'm glad that Sarah corrected me in my way that I had discussed that. It's important to think about this level of support that we can have for women, but yet we have this electability conversation at the same time.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is something that is sort of an old conversation. We've thought about women in politics for a really, really long time. I'm actually really excited because on Netflix, they're debuting a whole documentary on, a new film on Shirley Chisholm, who was the first Black woman to run for the presidency. And she's being played by Regina King. And I think that sometimes even representations in film, representations in our popular culture that allow us to see, imagine, envision what it looks like to see women in power and women in leadership from both the past and the present is really instrumental. Like, it's really hard to imagine something that you haven't seen before. And the truth of the matter is we have a lot of wonderful, powerful examples. And my job as a historian is to really sort of bring those people to light.
Politicians of all genders receive threats and scrutiny at times, whether it be online or in person. But I want to talk and continue to talk about women like Nancy Pelosi. Because of the inordinate amount of hate, one man going as far as attacking her husband in their home when he couldn't find her. Do you think the motivation behind that attack is something that's gendered? Are women like Pelosi experiencing something their male colleagues are not?
If I can chime in, this is Sarah. And I think there are a number of things that they experience that their male colleagues do not. But I think part of what is happening is that women and male politicians alike are attacked a lot online. It's a very difficult sort of environment, you know, to be in. But for women in particular, they're often attacked on the grounds that their very identities are unacceptable. So more so than their ideas or policies, but instead it's often their perceived race, gender, ethnicity, religion, sexual orientation, right? That becomes a central basis of condemnation. So if you think about Nikki Haley recently, you know, there were social media posts referring to her as Shiva, the deity of destruction, and that's invoking both her race and, you know, ethnicity and her gender. So as a woman of South Asian descent, you know, it's not so much that, you know, she's got this policy or that policy that's a problem, but instead let's sort of make the very grounds of who she is.
Essentially, you're saying they're trying to play all the hits, essentially, and just attack all facets of a person's background.
Yeah, I mean, I think you definitely see that if you look at Kamala Harris too, right? There are gendered and racialized epithets that she's dealt with, right? They sexualize her often in humiliating ways. They invoke these sort of oldest, not just racial and gender stereotypes, but specific racialized gender stereotypes where, you know, things that you would only say to, you know, a woman of a particular, you know, background. And so it's not just that they're hitting all of the identities, although I do joke that, you know, no one understands intersectionality like a troll. But I also think that it's more fundamental than that, because it's not just pointing out these very things. It's that these attributes make this person not fit, right? This is the problem, because that's not something you can address, right? Even if you wanted to, right? So I think that that's something that, even though men do deal with criticism and abuse and harassment, we do know that the volume is higher for women, and especially for women from the most marginalized groups.
This is, I want to get into, and we're going to play a couple of clips for you guys in a second. But before we do that, that's where we're going to get into a little bit more of the race and kind of the intersectionality aspect of it. But first, I just want to get you to touch on this a little further, Sarah. The internet, social media platforms, online forums, how much does that alter the threats against women today? Can we just drill a little deeper into that?
Oh, I mean, tremendously, right? Because there are all sorts of features about this that are significant. So it's not just that there are now places where what there have always been hecklers and, you know, people would send, you know, horrible things through the mail. But now there are spaces where, you know, anyone can fling content freely and potentially have a public audience for it. But it also increases the power of the ability to do that, because you can mount coordinated attacks. So for example, again, if referring back to Nikki Haley, you know, the people who were supporting Trump online, when Trump would make criticisms about her, make fun of her birth name, you know, these types of things, that then enables a group of people to work together in a way that can be really really impactful. And it's not just the platforms, because now it's also other forms of technologies, right? AI and deepfake technologies that allow people to create, realistic looking still photos and video images as well.
Yeah, if I could chime in here, I could just, I want to affirm everything that you're saying, because it really does become this coordinated effort to silence women, to marginalize women, and not just political figures as well. You see this in, the entertainment world. You see this among scholars as well. I myself, like during 2020, was, targeted and sent hate mail and put on professor watch lists. There is a concerted effort to silence women who are outspoken or speak up against patriarchy, speak up against racism. And even though we know that these things exist and they've been happening for centuries, it's still a terrifying position to be in, to feel as though your life might be at risk for speaking up. It's one thing to sort of like put something up online. It's another thing to sort of find out where someone lives and send them hate mail or go to their home to stalk them. When I think about Nancy Pelosi, and not just her being a woman, but also being a senior citizen, she's vulnerable to a physical attack. And I think that should alarm all of us.
Yeah, if I can add on to what Kelly's saying, too, it's also remarkable because although we're focusing so far on really prominent national figures, I appreciate what Kelly's saying about her own experience, because I think in a sense that Kamala Harris's or Nancy Pelosi's or Nikki Haley, they're almost the people I worry least about. It's because they have an apparatus support around them through the party, and because they have resources. I think if you are at the level of local politics, I think that it can be a lot scarier. It might be you and your staffer, if you're a state rep, that are working in your office. And I think that even we're seeing this kind of abuse and harassment trickle down to what we used to think of as really almost like mundane civil service. Like if you are
registrars of voters, poll monitors,
election.
If you're on the school committee or board of education, depending on your state, if you are, a poll worker, if you're working for the Department of Health, right? We've been seeing this sort of happen. And those folks don't have that kind of support network around them, and often don't have the resources to do the things that people in higher positions are able to do, like outsource their social media management or have bodyguards, have drivers in cars to get them places, those sorts of things.
Kelly, I also want to thank you for sharing that. We got you on a different list here on the Wheelhouse. We got you on a list of people we appreciate and people we want to call. So thank you so much for calling in today.
Let's hear.
I told you I want to play you a clip. I want to hear some of the rhetoric associated with our vice president. And it's interesting. This is kind of the I don't know if it's a catch 22, but the irony that it's going to come from a Nikki Haley when we just talked about some of the things that are said about Nikki Haley. Let's roll that clip.
We are going to have a female president of the United States. It will either be me or it will be Kamala Harris. And if Donald Trump is the nominee for the Republican Party, he will not win. And we will have a President Kamala Harris. I'm not going to allow that to happen.
Either of you guys could jump in on this. You feel free to. Why can't Kamala Harris be president? Why is how Haley's addressing Harris here problematic?
I mean, well, for one, she's speaking purely along political and ideological lines. So for her, any person that would occupy a Democratic seat would be someone who would be unacceptable or unsuitable to run the country. That's sort of first and foremost. But I also think that, in subtle ways, she is sort of dog whistling to this idea of we can't have this woman in power. And you know what I mean. And I think that that sort of like a subtle language or tone or way of getting people to have sort of that like wink, wink in your speak is something that listeners resonate with. They know exactly what she means when they say we cannot have someone like Kamala Harris, in the highest seat in the land. I also think, again, we've been talking about this a lot with Biden, and I feel bad, but it always comes back into his age and people thinking about, well, when you're older, you know, how close is in a health crisis is Kamala Harris away from this seat? But when it comes down to it, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you are a woman, you are going to experience intense political and social backlash when you take on a position of leadership such as the president of the United States.
This is where I want you to jump in, Sarah. You talked about earlier the politicians and supporters invoking racial epithets and on Nikki Haley and herself experiencing sexism, Donald Trump calling her bird brain many times. Mm-hmm. Given this experience, how do you interpret this clip?
I mean, I think there's a couple things that are worth noting in addition to what Kelly offered. One is that it's certainly not just men who are critical and hard on and mm-hmm. even abusive toward women. And so I think that, you know, on one hand, we would like to see something more out of someone who's sharing a similar set of burdens and challenges. But that's not very unusual, right? And that makes sense when you're, you know, sort of raised in a society. It's not that you're immune to its, you know, biases and stereotypes. So that's why people experience things like internalized racism, internalized sexism, that sort of thing. But the other thing is that I think this is strategic, like what Kelly's saying. So we don't really even know what Nikki Haley thinks outside of the fact that she thinks that this is a good strategy to reach the people who are potentially going to come out and vote. So in what it says most to me is about how she views the Republican primary voters and what she thinks will motivate them. And I couldn't agree more with what Kelly offered about the dog whistle, because it wasn't about policy per se in this moment. But again, just that, could you imagine if this happened? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Six women make up 3/4 of a group of lawmakers of color in Congress, often referred to as the Squad. Cori mm-hmm. Bush, Summer Lee, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, often attacked by Republicans for their progressive ideas. Former President Donald Trump, were invoking him again, even told some of them to go back to where they came from. These are women of color like Kamala Harris. I'm imagining that plays into how they're perceived by opponents across the aisle.
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead, Kelly. I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Squad is demonized primarily because they are women of color, because they have dared to sort of take up space to speak boldly truth to power. And that is alarming. And I think part of the reason that they're targeted is because they're beloved, right? Women look at them and they see them as role models. They see them as iconic. They see them as brilliant. They see them as what might be possible for themselves. And they represent a real shift in the way that we can think about, you know, what leadership looks like. I think about someone like Cori Bush that represents not just Black women, but like working class Black women. When we think about the class dynamics that play into what leadership looks like, I think that's so important. You know, when I think about Ayanna Pressley and I think about like her alopecia and what it means to show up to work with a bald head and to be bold and to be beautiful and to take up space in that way. In some ways, what these women are doing is absolutely incredible. But again, there will always be intense and even violent backlash when you speak out against racism and white supremacy and patriarchy. And I think we see that time and time again with these women.
Finish this thought that we had earlier when we talked about Nikki Haley talking in a matter that anybody who's a Democrat is unsuitable. What about the role now we have? One of these we're talking about six women here, so six women of color, and then we talk about political affiliation and the politics. So now let's factor in the politics and the affiliation into this conversation.
I mean, I think it's all entwined in a way that's really complex. And I think one way that you can see this coming up, so I guess in a way I'm setting aside part of that question for a minute to sort of go back a step to say that in my own research looking at identity-based abuse, one of the things that's really kind of paradoxical and fascinating about it is that it's both really intimate and ad hominem, you know, it's very mm-hmm. personal sounding, but the attacks are also generic. So what's weird is obviously if you're calling someone, you know, a whore and, you know, these crazy things, that feels very personal. But if you look at the content of the abuse, the attacks could mm-hmm. often be lobbed at nearly anyone with the similar background demographically. Mm-hmm. So thinking back for a minute to, you know, going back away from the squad to thinking about when Kamala Harris got the vice presidential nomination, and there were these memes and shirts that said Joe and the Ho, right? Mm-hmm. And those memes and jokes that were circulated could have been and would have been used even if the nominee had been Gretchen Whitmer or Tammy Duckworth. And I point this out because mm-hmm. I think the sort of non-specific misogyny and racism that is embedded there, it's a red flag that reminds us that even though the abuse looks and feels more like interpersonal bullying, it's really a more structural hostility that's rooted in resistance to the visibility and voice of these individual speakers. So whether it's AOC or Ilhan Omar, right, as representatives of specific groups of people. So it's really about a struggle to push back against who is allowed to hold sway in public mm-hmm. discourse. And I think that's why those members of the squad are so threatening, because once you recognize this not as an individual problem that Nancy Pelosi or AOC or whoever is dealing with a lot of abuse, and you recognize this as patterned resistance to women's mm-hmm. political voice and visibility, then you can kind of see, oh, this is why the abuse and harassment is unevenly distributed, even among women. Because if it's about resisting certain groups of people, then we understand why this group, the squad, right, they are at the, you know, if you make a Venn diagram of who's most likely to deal with this kind of garbage, one circle would be women who are members of multiple marginalized groups, as mm-hmm. these women are that you've called out. Another circle would be those who are complicating or just existing in realms that are traditionally male dominated, of which politics and policy is certainly one. And another is, and this is where the sort of politics piece that you asked about, Frankie, comes in, is that there's special venom, say, mm-hmm. for women who are perceived as feminist or in any way non-compliant with gender expectations. And there is a very low bar for that kind of non-compliance. But so if you are politically then left in this gendered way, right, you are literally at the center of that Venn diagram. And that's mm-hmm. where Ayanna Pressley, that's where Ilhan Omar, that's where AOC, right, that's where these women are situated.
Sarah and Kelly, Go ahead, Kelly, just really quickly, because we're about to go to break.
I was just going
to
say, what's so ridiculous about this is that it's not even, the critiques are not even creative. The critiques are not about policy or how they voted or what issues they're standing on. The critiques are always about their personhood, and that's what makes it a problem.
Just coming with the fire in the last couple of minutes here to really harp on this important conversation. We've barely scratched the surface. We've got a lot more to come. We have to take a quick break, though. Coming up, more on women in politics. Stick with us. Join the conversation, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davita Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umeshankar has advice on the first, most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important, because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. March is Women's History Month, so today we're talking about women in politics, diving into some of the harmful rhetoric surrounding women in American politics, and joined by two great guests, Kelly Carter Jackson, chair of the Africana Studies Department at Wellesley College, and Sarah Soberai, professor and chair of sociology at Tufts University. Kelly, we touched on the impressive credentials of a Vice President Kamala Harris earlier. Here in Connecticut, the highest elected office held by a woman in state politics is Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewitz. I talked to her about some of the hate directed at Kamala Harris. Here's what she said.
More qualified than some men who have been president of the United States. It's remarkable to me when I hear people talk about the credentials of our vice president as somehow being inferior. And I have to attribute that to discrimination.
Can you react to that clip for us, Kelly?
Yeah, I mean, she's not wrong. She's not wrong. I mean, I think that there are valid critiques to make of Kamala Harris's leadership, for sure. But I think oftentimes those critiques are ways to sort of undermine her personhood, a way to sort of demonize and subjugate who she is as a woman of color. So when we see critiques that are all based upon either what she looks like or who she's married to or sort of her background that have nothing to do with actual like decisions and policy, that's where I take real issue. I think all of us should be open to critique as a leader when we think about the hard decisions that we have to make, if we're talking about immigration or if we're talking about, you know, crime or things of that nature. But when it comes to who you are as a person, those things should be off the table. But yet, when it comes to Kamala Harris, it seems that all we seem to discuss are the things that have actually nothing to do with her leadership.
Sarah, what do we know about how this impacts a woman to want to get into politics, seeing such vitriol out there, people attacking personhood, this cyberspace issue that we have where there's this terrible online hate that women face? What do we know about the impact?
Oh, it's got a terrible, I mean, it has a terrible impact. I know from working myself with women who've been on the receiving end of this kind of abuse, a lot of them, you know, leave social media platforms, take breaks to recover from fear and frustration. They write under pseudonyms or use male avatars, right? They self-censor, right? There's all sorts of things that come of this. And then if you're watching, so that pipeline question that you're asking about, if you are watching this unfold, not just, again, I can't stress enough how it's not just running for a national level office. If you are visible in the public eye speaking about social or political issues, really in any way. So if you are a journalist, if you are a public intellectual, if you're a comedian, right? Mm-hmm. If you are out there speaking, if you're a pundit, right? Speaking about these issues, it can be an incredibly uncomfortable space. And so for activists or advocacy folks as well. So if you're a young woman looking on and you're seeing activists, candidates, journalists, people, women in office, right, treated this way, it becomes really clear that political voice and visibility are high risk endeavors. And I definitely think, you know, that more narrow or more focused question that you asked about sort of running for office or being in politics, you know, this is the last thing we want to do, right? I think it's a funny, it feels almost entertaining given the amount of conversation that's happening in this particular election cycle, where we hear a huge number of people saying they're not happy with either of the you know, main options on the ballot, mm-hmm. that we do not want to scare away 50% of the, you know, eligible pool. We want the best and the brightest and the people who are willing to do that work. And again, not just in politics, but this is a space where it's especially visible. And so that's another thing that I think is worth attending to, because what that reminds us is that this does not just affect the women who are targeted and their families. It affects all of us, right? It is a threat to democracy to allow there to be a space where our low-level civil servants, you know, people who don't want to run for school committee or people who don't want to be a poll watcher, right? If this becomes higher risk, if activism, if advocacy, if running to be a state rep become high risk, that's going to have an impact on all
When we talk about, and somebody invoked President Biden's age earlier, mostly because of the Kamala Harris and being president conversation, that naturally pops up. But the fitness question, or the fitness part of the question, is what is addressed mostly in politics when we talk about President Biden's age. We don't necessarily talk about the impact that it has on women like the women that are in the squad or other young people that might not get the opportunity to run for president, because you generally have to be an older white man to run for president. So let's talk about representation then, Kelly, and what that does to a person and how it impacts them.
I think there's a couple of things. I think when it comes to age, I do think that we, especially in America, have not set a healthy model for what it looks like to step down, to pass the baton, to rest, to sort of enter a different phase of life. I think we run and go hard until we die, and I don't think that that's healthy. I think it looks really good to be able to see, this is what a transition of power can look like. This is how you mentor people and then pass the baton to the people that you mentored and allow them to lead and so forth and so on. I also think that what worries me about sort of this toxic political climate that we find ourselves in is that, you know, when we retreat, the terrorists win. When I say that, I mean, if we sort of withdraw from these political spaces, places of power, positions of influence, if we're not at the table, we are on the table. And so what I'm always trying to encourage women to do, especially teaching, you know, at Wellesley College or Women's College, I love teaching women, I love inspiring the next generation of women leaders, is that we have to be in the room. We have to have a voice, we have to have a say. And even though pioneer work is hard, and even though pioneer work can be violent, we have to be able to do this hard work to change the culture, to shift the narrative. Because if we don't, no one will. We can't wait for the people in power to sort of relinquish it. That's not going to happen. We have to be, I think, even more sort of forward and even forceful about how we speak up for ourselves and how we protect one another when we do that, too. I think that's so important that both men and women support one another. When you see that woman speaking up, when you see her running for a position, that she has sort of the support that she needs to stay in that job, to keep doing that job. We have not set up, I think, healthy parameters for success either. And that has to change.
Kelly talked about women of color being in the room. Want to talk a little bit about the benefits of having a diverse group of legislators. Something I talked about with Susan Bysiewicz, Connecticut's lieutenant governor. Says that she and the governor of Connecticut have been extremely intentional about choosing agency leaders and judicial nominees.
We have such a diverse administration. About half of our commissioners are women. More than a third are people of color. And we had diverse, competent voices at the table, and they helped us make better decisions because they understood all of the different communities that we have in Connecticut.
Connecticut's seen as one of the municipalities, one of the states that did well in COVID times to try to protect people from the virus. That's why she was talking about that and the impact that women particularly had in that decision-making process. What are some of the things that could be done to get more women to participate in democracy, in politics? Mm-hmm. I'll open this conversation up to you guys to make politics more inclusive.
Well, I think one thing that comes to mind is, and it relates to that question about being an older white male, is that the money required to run for office, right? The way we have campaign finance structured is one where the vast majority of our country would not be able to sort of mount a campaign that would be treated as credible. And although people are able to work their way up, you know, if you start as a local state rep and, you know, you sort of get different positions and work your way up, even those local level elections require some sort of funds and fundraising. Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons that we see older white men in the highest offices, it has to do with also the way that our economic resources are distributed in the U.S. and the way that that coupled with who's willing to donate to which campaign. So I think one thing we can do is provide more of a level playing ground where mm-hmm. the ideas and relationships in a community have a bigger role in how things unfold than who can buy the best advertising spots.
Yeah, I agree. I think money is a huge barrier to entry. I think that oftentimes women struggle to find the sort of financial support that they need. But in addition to financial support, you know, for a lot of women who are mothers, sort of having that village of support to be able to say, yes, you can have children, have a family, and still take up powerful positions. I have a friend who in the town next to me just ran for a select board and won. And she's the first Black woman ever in the town of Natick to serve on the mm-hmm. select board. And I thought about how powerful it was for my daughters to, you know, hold out signs for her on campaign day and to see, like, you know, if this is something that you wanted to pursue, it is possible, whether it's at the local level or at the state level or even at the national level. We need to be able to see women taking up these positions, which is why representation is so important. But also when women are in those positions, when they do get there, they have to be supported. They have to be mentored. They have to be not just recruited, but retained, as we say in corporate America. Like, all of the facets that go to bringing a person in have to remain once the person is also in the job.
Yeah, and I think the abuse and harassment that is intimidating to a lot of folks, I don't think we want to treat that as inevitable. Mm-hmm. The sentiments may be always circulating, but it is not something that there are ways that we can minimize it. And there are things that can be done that should be taken seriously and not just throwing our hands up like, what can you do?
We're going to end the conversation in a second, but we got a phone call. And it's an interesting phone call because I believe Douglas from East Haven is going to talk to us about some backlash that Katie Britt, who was a recent responder to the State of the Union, received mm-hmm. in her address to President Biden. Go ahead, Douglas. What do you got to say?
Hi. We were talking about the feeling that women are getting trashed very publicly for their participation in politics, and there seems to be no clearer example of this than Senator Britt, who did a terrible job by all accounts on the State of the Union response. But she was just trashed everywhere for it, and very little of the discussion centered around the fact that she was asked to do this in a particular way and coached to do it in a particular way. And the responses have basically been putting her down for what she did and not addressing as much of why was she set up for this and how do we support a woman in this role and still critique what was obviously terrible about it. I certainly don't agree with anything that she said or anything about it. I thought it was appalling, but it certainly is an example of being trashed.
Hey, Douglas, thank you so much for calling this morning. We appreciate your phone call. Is this more, guys, and we got to do this quick, is this more about Katie Britt being a woman, or is it more about the this being an opportunity to critique somebody for their politics? What are your thoughts there?
Good question for Doug. I'm so glad you brought that up because it's a perfect example of that tightrope, right? So I don't know who whose idea this was.
To have her in a kitchen.
Right. But you're going to have, maybe this was an attempt to make her seem non-threatening, to sort of have it both ways. Here we have a woman in a prominent role in politics. So we're going to put her in the kitchen and, have these sort of, family related messages, right? These sorts of things. But it did not work. And the abuse and harassment that came back at her as a result was really, really quite striking. And you're right. I don't know if anybody lost their jobs behind the scene, but I think that was a pretty noteworthy.
So grateful to have Kelly Carter Jackson and Sarah Soberai this morning. Hoping that we can have them on the Wheelhouse more. I appreciate you all coming this morning. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to get an update on the attacks on reproductive rights in Alabama and across the nation. Join the conversation, just as Douglas just did, 888-720-9677.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
So, you've never donated to this station before? That's okay. Public Media Giving Days are a great time to make your first gift. Here's how.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We've been talking about women in politics, how they're spoken about, how they're spoken to. Now we're going to go and dive into some of the current battles for reproductive rights happening in Alabama and across the country. Joining me now, I have Shefali Luthra, health reporter for the 19th. Shefali, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for so much of the great work that the 19th does. So glad to have another reporter from the 19th on. Folks want to join the conversation, call us real quick if you have a phone call, 888-720-9677, because we are in the final segment. And we got to talk about the recent attacks on reproductive rights across the U.S. Some of that legislation set into motion in 2022 with the Dobbs versus Jackson opinion. Shefali, can you remind our listeners about that decision?
Of course. We are approaching the two-year anniversary of the Dobbs decision, which is one of the most consequential Supreme Court rulings of my lifetime, certainly. It overturned Roe v. Wade, undoing almost 50 years of abortion rights protections, and essentially threw the nation's reproductive health into somewhat of a disarray, allowing states to ban abortion if they choose, letting these laws that had been written but never taken effect suddenly have the power to outlaw a whole class of healthcare, essentially, and really drastically reshaped what pregnancy care looks like, and really added a layer of differential danger based on where you live in terms of what it means to become pregnant.
And the landscape since then, I'd imagine more restrictive, particularly in some southern states?
That's correct. We have whole segments of the country where abortion is almost completely unavailable. If you look at the Southeast, Florida is the most permissive state with a 15-week allowance for abortion. North Carolina is the next closest state to Florida with a 12-week allowance. And everything in between there on the Eastern Seaboard doesn't allow the procedure any later than 6 weeks. It really does mean that people are struggling to access care. Abortion is a fairly common procedure, and it's also one that comes up quite often for if you experience miscarriage, if you discover an anomaly in your pregnancy, if something goes wrong where you can't give birth. Doctors rely on abortion as an option when it means that staying pregnant is not the safest option for a patient.
Latest attacks on reproductive rights have been targeting IVF, in vitro fertilization. I spoke to the Reach Fund of Connecticut, a nonprofit led by Jessica Puck that helps patients here pay for abortions. She says the news in Alabama is an example of what advocates have been saying for years, that the fight against reproductive rights wouldn't stop at abortion. Here's a clip.
This is about control. It's about controlling who can get pregnant and when they can get pregnant. And it sets dangerous precedents for personhood laws, which will greatly affect the care and the rights of people.
I want you to expand on what we just heard, Shefali, about it really being about control. And Alabama, are they emboldened by what happened with Dobbs? Maybe that's an obvious answer.
The Alabama case is actually somewhat complicated. To your first point, there is an ideology that is quite common in a sector of the anti-abortion movement called fetal personhood, the idea that a being is live, deserves the same protections as humans from the moment of conception. And this has pretty significant implications. There is this very vocal segment of the anti-abortion movement that does oppose IVF because of the creation of embryos in a lab, not all of which are used to become a pregnancy to eventually result in a birth. There's also a segment that opposes forms of contraception, arguing along similar lines. But I want to take a moment and remind readers exactly what happened in Alabama, which is that this wasn't the result of a law passed specifically post-Dobbs. This was because a couple sued a fertility clinic that had an accident and the embryos were destroyed. And they sued for wrongful death. And the state Supreme Court upheld that, citing an amendment to the state's constitution, and essentially unleashed this level of chaos that the state legislature and the governor were not prepared for, which is why we've seen efforts by Republican lawmakers in Alabama to try and bring IVF back. But at the same time, what it sort of speaks to is that we are seeing unintended or perhaps unanticipated consequences of the anti-abortion movement and the fetal personhood ideology now taking us in a very broad direction with significant ramifications for all forms of reproductive health.
Very important that you brought that part to light. How are folks who have been going through this process, maybe even for years, being impacted by these unforeseen kind of consequences and this attack on access to IVF?
The IVF question is so striking because it's already a really emotionally, physically, and financially fraught decision. I spoke to numerous people going through IVF, not necessarily in Alabama, but in other states with abortion restrictions, about how they're feeling in this moment. And a lot of them echoed these same themes. They are doing IVF because they're out of options and they are desperate to have a child. They have spent thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars trying to become pregnant, you know, taking out new jobs to get fertility benefits, delaying needed renovations on their homes, pulling money out of their savings. And now they are so afraid that something might come and take this thing away from them that they have fought so hard to be able to access because IVF is already so unattainable for so many. It's really changing how they think about their pregnancy plans, whether they want to rush into the next pregnancy, whether they want to spend extra money to transfer their embryos to another state. And they really don't know what their options are going to be in the coming years. And it's a source of real fear for them.
You've alluded to a sort of scramble that's happened as a result of the state government not being able to deal with these sort of unintended consequences. So do you think the attacks against IVF are going to stand?
It's a good question. Alabama passed a law after a couple of weeks that provides immunity for IVF clinics. And in theory, it should restore access to the procedure. And we've seen some clinics in Alabama resume providing IVF, saying that these protections are sufficient. At least one clinic hasn't. And they are particularly concerned that though this law provides them immunity from, you know, civil or criminal charges, it doesn't undo the state Supreme Court's central finding, which is that in the moment of conception, you deserve the same legal protection as a human. And that, if that is something that lawmakers aren't able to tackle and address, it could come back in many different forms and continue to have implications for people's access to healthcare.
What can you tell us about the experience of providers right now? Have you been able to talk to any and how they're feeling about these latest legislative changes?
There were a collection of physicians who worked with the state to try and pass the law that is in place, but the National Trade Group for Reproductive Medicine Providers is deeply concerned that the Alabama law does not go far enough. They worry that in the long term, this will not provide their members the protection they need. And they also note something that I think is very important, which is that if you don't have necessarily the full spectrum of reproductive health available in a state, it deters doctors from moving there. And Alabama, like a lot of states that also happen to have abortion bans, already have shortages of physicians, and in particular, reproductive health physicians and specialized reproductive health physicians. And longer term, they have noted they are quite concerned that those shortages will only get worse because doctors will choose to practice in states where they are not concerned about legal risk.
Shefali, I've only got about a minute and a half left in this conversation, and I want you to talk to us about a book you got coming out this year. Can you do that in about a minute? Can you tell our listeners what it's about and where they can get a copy and when?
Absolutely. This book is called Undue Burden. It is the result of years of reporting in the lead up and aftermath of the Dobbs decision. It follows the experiences of the actual people who sought abortions and what it meant to them to be able or unable to access this care in states across the country. It comes out May 21st. You can buy it wherever bookstores are sold, or wherever books are sold. You can pre-order it online. And I really hope that it helps people understand the human lives that are dramatically affected by what happens when abortion is outlawed in so many states.
Important conversation, an important book to read. Shefali Luthra, thank you so much for coming on our program. We appreciate you. We appreciate the 19th.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show for this week. Today's show produced by Chloe Wynn, my partner in bringing politics to the people. Edited by Meg Dalton. Technical producer is Kat Pastor. Thanks to Katie Pellico for helping us in studio. Download The Wheelhouse anytime on your favorite podcast app. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. Thank you for listening.